Welcome to Direct Talk Radio, conversations with writers, directors, and artists. I'm your host, Joseph Miller. Anglo-American actor Ian Ruskin trained at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art and performed in England for 15 years. He came to Los Angeles in 1985 and worked primarily in television, usually guest starring as the intelligent bad guy in shows such as Murder, She Wrote, Scarecrow and Mrs. King, and MacGyver. This work paid the rent, but did not in any way fulfill his dream as a student of the Royal Academy to work in plays that would affect an audience. But a pivotal moment arrived in 1994 while playing the lead in Rob Sullivan's play Strike Story, the Harry Bridges story. A rehearsed reading before the ILWU, the renowned labor leaders' own union, was capped by a 10-minute standing ovation.
The response was overwhelming. I mean, we had like a 10-minute standing ovation. It was, I remember standing on the stage and thinking, this is the feeling I haven't had for a while, that this is something worth doing.
Ruskin couldn't let Bridges go. And 5 years later, put his hand to writing and recording radio documentaries and one-man plays, including From Wharf Rats to Lords of the Docks, which was eventually directed and filmed for PBS. In 2010, Ruskin received a COLA fellowship, that is, from the city of Los Angeles, to write his play to begin the world over again, The Life of Thomas Paine, and has toured over 60 performances to date, including Harvard Law School, the American Philosophical Society, the ACLU, and the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. What's more, a film adaptation, narrated by Elliot Gould, is now complete and will be featured on PBS nationwide later this year. Ruskin brings his play to Santa Barbara on Saturday afternoon, February 13th. For one performance at the Faulkner Gallery at the Central Public Library. The performance is free and hosted by the Institute of World Culture. I spoke with Ruskin by phone a week before the performance.
Well, I wanted to start off and just ask a little bit about your background and maybe just a little bit about your education, your interest in theater, and if you think of yourself foremost as an actor or a writer.
I certainly have always thought of myself first as an actor, because I only started writing 16 years ago, and I've been an actor all my life. So, yes, I would say I'm an actor who now also writes. But what that has led to is that basically the only acting I do now is my own material. So that's, you know, my career took a direction I had no idea it would. I've always acted from when I was maybe 10 or 11. I used to do, you know, amateur productions. I actually grew up partly in America and particularly was in Philadelphia. When I was 8 to about 13, and that's when I started. There's a wonderful amateur company that's still there called the Stagecrafters, where I was in Auntie Mame playing Patrick the son, and I did some other plays in sort of colleges, you know, where they needed a 10-year-old. And always felt very at home. It just felt completely natural and right to do that. We then went back to England from where I had come, and I then auditioned and went to RADA Drama School, and from there, you know, went into repertory theatre, then worked in London, following a fairly traditional path, I would say, and then came out to Los Angeles. It's now 28 years ago.
Okay.
And, you know, I felt I had to either go really to Los Angeles or New York, and New York just terrified me. So I came to L.A. Much easier to somehow arrive in Los Angeles. And then it was, as I say, it actually was in 1994, I was cast in a play about a man called Harry Bridges, who I'd never heard of, who was a real person. He had kind of been the driving force behind founding the West Coast Longshore Union, the ILWU, and was a very radical, visionary man and union leader. And I got very interested in him, and that led eventually, a few years later, to me actually, that's when I first, the first thing I did actually, I was given a grant to produce a radio documentary about him. But my idea was always to write a one-man play. The play that I had been in had, I think, 12 actors, and it never went anywhere because it was too expensive to put on, basically. And that's when I had this idea of a one-man play. I had done one one-man play in my life that I hadn't written, a wonderful play in England.
Was it a biographical piece? I mean, was it based on a real...
No, it was called The Man Himself. It was by a writer called Alan Drury, and it was a study of a man in London on the point of joining a very right-wing fascist organization, and why he would do that, what took him to that point. It was an amazing piece. It's a very, very sparse, finely written piece. Anyway, I had done that. In fact, I did that in Rep and in London and in Los Angeles. But I'd never written anything until I wrote eventually this play about Harry Bridges. And then 3-4 years ago, Thomas Paine came along.
But that's interesting that Harry Bridges, Thomas Paine, and the earlier one you mentioned all have to do with politics. At least in one sense.
Yes. I think one of the things that drove me to write the Bridges play and the Paine play is that they are so misunderstood, and politically as well as socially and economically and philosophically. And have been kind of relegated or almost written out of the history books. And yet, obviously, Thomas Paine had an enormous impact on the whole world. And Bridges had a very big impact on the American labor movement, far beyond just his own union. And yet they, because they were, I guess you could use the word radical, they were, you know, kind of gently erased, which made me angry.
Poli-sci professor in college who reminded his students that radical comes etymologically from the same root as radish. Radical, most truly, rather than simply being destructive or anarchic, radical is somebody who goes back to the foundations, goes back to the root, clears away the illegitimate overgrowth.
I didn't know that. That's very interesting, because I'm never quite sure whether that means to people that you are of the left or the right. It means you quite away from the center, I guess.
Yes,
but in my mind, it usually means to the left. But that's just a word.
Right. But that's significant. I mean, that etymology is significant when we look at the subtitle of your play. To begin the world over again.
Which is what he wrote and what he believed. Well, that was the Age of Enlightenment. That was he wasn't the only man who ever thought that. Because the world really was, I mean, I'm no scholar, but was, coming out of basically the Middle Ages and getting out from under the total dominance in Europe of the church, the Catholic Church mainly, and there were these huge scientific advances starting, I guess, with Newton, really, so that the human race was beginning to kind of take charge of themselves. You know, the fact that we went round the sun, not the sun around us. Well, that was a huge concept.
Mm-hmm.
And all those kinds of ideas were coming up, and it did, I think, seem to a lot of people that the human race, or at least the Western Europe, could come out from under this suspicion and dogma and superstition and actually kind of take charge of the world and understand the world. It's a wonderful phrase. We have it in our power to begin the world over again. And that is Thomas Paine.
You're listening to Direct Talk Radio, conversations with writers, directors, and artists. This is Joseph Miller, and my guest this week is English-American actor and writer Ian Ruskin, who brings his one-man play, To Begin the World Over Again, The Life of Thomas Paine, to the Faulkner Gallery on Saturday, February 13th at 3 p.m. The free performance is sponsored by the Institute of World Culture.
Going back to your career, the Harry Bridges project then was kind of a watershed for you, and that's what really, writing the one-man version of that was sort of your discovering yourself as a theater writer.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I had reached a point where I wasn't getting that much work in the industry, and the work I was getting I found very unsatisfying. And when I went to drama school, even when you were lucky in rep, you were doing great plays, and you were doing plays that you felt could affect people, could make people think, you know. You'd hope that people would leave the theater a little bit richer than when they came in.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came here and I was doing kind of cops and robbers stuff, if I was lucky, on television, it didn't mean anything, really.
Right.
And it was only when we did a performance of this, the first Bridges play, which I didn't write, where I just was performing as Bridges, to his union. And it was a rehearsed reading at their convention. This was in 1994. And the response was overwhelming. I mean, we had like a 10-minute standing ovation. It
mm-hmm.
was, and obviously this man, Bridges, for these people in the union, had an enormous place in their hearts and in their lives, although he had died 5-6 years earlier. I remember standing on the stage and thinking, this is the feeling I haven't had for a while,
mm-hmm.
that this is something worth doing. And then, you know, it took me a few years, it took me 5 years, really, to kind of get up the courage, I guess, to convince myself that maybe I could actually write something. I mean, I'd always loved writing in school, but I'd never written a play or a book or anything. What really drove me was that this was a great story. He saw both these character men also had their ups and downs, and they had their weaknesses and their flaws, which you have to have in a play. You can't, you know,
right.
just write about a Superman. And they had many, many challenges, and had their ups and downs. The kind of things that Bridges was talking about, I just totally agreed with. And once I started performing the play, I know the play inspires people to make better lives for themselves and for others. Because that's what he saw the union movement being about, not just better wages and things, but about democracy and bringing peace to the world. I mean, he saw big, big things. Ask me another question.
No, that's fascinating. Hasn't it become a bit of an old-fashioned idea, the using theater to ennoble people and enunciate ideas? And hasn't a great, I mean, there seems to be a place for that, but theater has seems to be dominated more by amusement or you know, artsy innovation.
To me, I mean, I think one of the greatest plays ever written is Private Lives by Noel Coward, which is a very light, fluffy thing, if you like. You know, he wrote it in 3 days, which is astounding. Mm. I think it's a great play because it's very, very funny. But also, I think if you see that play, you walk out saying, oh, my God, you know, I do that, don't I? That's just how I treat my wife or my husband or whatever. That people see their own, you know, habits and faults and maybe strengths as well. I don't think a play has to be, you know, heavy or political. But, I mean, Chekhov is one of the great writers of all time, obviously. And he wrote, even though he was writing about these bored landed gentry in Russia, people could identify with some of the humanity that was there. that to me is what's important. What I get bored with is when you're doing things where basically everyone's shooting each other and dying and the character doesn't necessarily have to be likable.
Of course.
You do have to feel for the character.
Of course.
I think. And if you don't feel for him or don't care at all, then there's not much point in being there. Even if in the end you say, you know, he really was a jerk, wasn't he? But you got to see some struggle because that's what interests people, I think.
Yeah.
I don't particularly like what's sometimes called political theater, where a political point is hammered.
Oh, yes.
Although I think all good theater is political.
Mm.
But you don't have to hammer people with it. And really, theater's about humanity. It's about, you know, people's feelings and inner lives and how, and like I say, I always would hope that, there was a wonderful comment, because we have filmed the Payne play, as we did with the Bridges play.
Yes.
And it's going to be distributed to public television this summer.
That's fantastic.
Year,
congratulations.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very exciting. But that we, in fact, it was Haskell Wexler, who was a legendary, mainly cinematographer and director, Academy Awards, extraordinary man. The filming of the Thomas Paine play was the last theatrical thing he shot. He died about a month ago. He was 93. He'd lived a long, full life. And he was the cinematographer on everything, Bound for Glory, Thomas Crown Affair, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, American Graffiti. I mean, just on and on and on and on. Extraordinary. But he, after the filming, he was interviewing audience members as they were leaving, and we made a little special feature of that. And he's asked this one woman who's probably in her 70s as she's coming out. So, had you ever heard of Thomas Paine? She says, "Well, I'm a professor of American history." And he just howls at laughter. But he says, "How did the play make you feel?" And she says, "It makes me want to live my own life better."
Oh.
And that's it. That's the comment. And that's what Payne was trying to get people to do. So that's, to me, what theater is ideally about.
You're listening to Direct Talk Radio, conversations with writers, directors, and artists. This is Joseph Miller, and my guest this week is English-American actor and writer Ian Ruskin, who brings his one-man play, To Begin the World Over Again, The Life of Thomas Paine, to the Faulkner Gallery on Saturday, February 13th at 3 p.m. The free performance is sponsored by the Institute of World Culture.
Did Paine regard himself as sort of a prophet of liberty? I mean, there's something so extraordinary about his story. He seemed to regard America as sort of the exclusive possible asylum for liberty.
Well, good question. I think, you know, when he arrived in Philadelphia, he was 37, and his life had been just a series of disasters, basically. And he had made no real impact anywhere, in any way.
Except in the coffee houses.
Right?
In the coffee houses?
He had learned how to debate. He'd done a lot of debating in London and in Lewes, where he then lived, in coffee houses and things. But that was about it. That's all he had really achieved on a sort of professional or personal level. And I think the first thing is, I think when he arrived in Philadelphia, and I felt this to some extent when I arrived in Los Angeles, that he felt freed from that history, and he felt anything was possible in this new place. Because he hadn't had any failures in Philadelphia, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He had no history, he had no baggage of Philadelphia. So I think that's one thing. That somehow, because there has to be some explanation for how he, because what he did start to do was to seriously write when he got to Philadelphia. He'd done a lot of debating, he had a lot of ideas in his head, but he started to write. So something was released in him. And I think for many years, I mean, all through the Revolution, he did see America as having the potential to lead the world as a new kind of nation with a new kind of equality and democracy, and I mean it was true that at that point there wasn't, I don't think, any other nation in Europe, anyway, in the Western world, that had any of those same kind of ideas of freedom and democracy, because they were all, I think they were almost all ruled by kings and queens, or certainly authoritarian governments. So Paine, he really did think that this was the great turning point, I think. Then, by the end of the Revolution, and in the few years after the Revolution, he became very disillusioned with America.
Hmm.
Because he felt, as did other people, that what the war had done was to create two classes in America of the rich, who had been rich before, but got richer through the war. And these were landowners and merchants and the people who made bullets and all of that. And then there was everybody else. That's how Paine saw it. He also was very disappointed that the war did not lead to the end of slavery, which he was always against. And so he left. You know, he left partly because he had this... He basically said, "I'm done. I'm done. I'm putting down my pen. I'm finished." And he had always been an inventor, and always designing all kinds of things, including this idea of a wrought iron bridge. Now, he wasn't the only one to be doing this, but the idea that you build bridges where there are no central spans going down into the water,
mm-hmm.
so it's just an arc across. Because the problem with those piers, especially in the American Northeast, is you get ice, and then the ice breaks up, and it comes down the rivers, and it takes out those piers, and the bridges collapse.
Uh-huh.
So he was very, very excited by this bridge, and there was actually, in the end, a sort of 100-foot model was built in London. But he took the idea to the French Academy of Science on the recommendation of Ben Franklin. And then he got involved in the French Revolution. And then I think, again, his hopes were rekindled, because initially the French Revolution really was about achieving equality. America wasn't about equality. You know, America was not designed initially to be a democracy. You know, all the huge debates about which white men should be able to vote. That was the big debate. And what they could vote for, where the power would lie, and the idea that if you destroy the system that has always ruled a people, of the king and the nobles, who are the best educated and most sophisticated and all of that, if you take them away, who's going to rule? You're going to have a bunch of ignorant farmers running a country?
Well, that's right. Before Paine, the word democracy was pejorative.
Yes. And, you know, John Adams went with common sense, said it is so democratical. I fear the effect it will have among the people. It is so democratical. So there was this, I have a line in the play that, you know, democracy dangerously concentrates political power in the hands of the many.
Right.
And so that was a huge debate in America, as it still is.
Yeah, that's right. It still is, the whole, without getting into contemporary things, the whole Bernie Sanders thing and the Trump thing are very interesting in the light of what you just said.
Well, yeah, and also the fact that there is gerrymandering, the fact that there is still voter suppression.
Yes.
Without any question.
Right. Yeah.
When you have 6-hour lines of people to stand in to vote, and you take away all the portable toilets, so they have to leave the line, and then they lose their right to vote. That's so outrageous. Paine would be absolutely outraged. And this is not about a party. This is about everyone should vote.
Right.
I'm sure he would say certainly presidential elections should be a holiday. I'm sure he would say, 50 years ago, this country landed men on the moon, and they still don't know how to count people's votes. This is just absurd. But anyway, so he went to France, and again, he had they really were talking about equality and fraternity, and he loved it until it all went wrong with the terror.
Right.
And until he...
And he got on the wrong side of that.
He did, and technically because he was English, but the real reason was that he fought very hard to spare the life of the king.
Yeah.
He said that he wanted the French king to be exiled in America.
He was against capital punishment.
In principle, yes, and also on a practical level. He said, I have no fight with monarchs. My fight is with the monarchy. And he said, every king should have the distinct privilege of becoming a private citizen. So he was not into cutting off their heads. He was into making them just into private citizens.
Reminds me of, in parenting, people say, punish the act, not the child, or, you know.
Yeah, uh-huh.
You know, in fact, Paine said, talked about an avidity to punish is always dangerous to liberty. It leads men to stretch, to misinterpret, and to misapply even the best of laws. He that would make his own liberty secure must guard even his enemy from oppression, for if he violates this duty, he establishes a precedent that will reach to himself.
Yes, I didn't know the first part. I know the second half of that quote, but the first part I had never heard. Beware of what you do to others. It's do unto others as you would have them do unto you, basically.
Yes.
But it will come back and haunt you.
That's right.
And that's a constant. That's also a very, very big issue today with terrorism, with national security, with the idea of government surveillance. And, you know, there's a real debate there.
There is.
But you have to be careful of the people we call terrorists turning us into terrorists ourselves.
You are listening to Direct Talk Radio, conversations with writers, directors, and artists. This is Joseph Miller, and my guest this week is English-American actor and writer Ian Ruskin, who brings his one-man play, To Begin the World Over Again, The Life of Thomas Paine, to the Faulkner Gallery on Saturday, February 13th at 3 p.m. The free performance is sponsored by the Institute of World Culture.
Going back for a moment to his landing in Philadelphia, his becoming a writer and editor, isn't it true that there was something special about his writing style? He wasn't writing like an inflated, educated man, but he was able to render complex ideas intelligible to average readers.
Absolutely. That, I mean, because he was not the only man, especially in Europe, with these ideas. But I, when I was reading, you know, and working on the script, I read just short passages from other writers of the time, and a sentence would take an entire page, and it would be so beautiful and flow and full of such wonderful images of rushing water. Nobody else wrote like Paine. And, yeah, he wrote, he said in short, simple sentences. That's what made him dangerous. That's why he was always, in a way, on the outside, because he incited the masses.
You know, well, that's interesting, the whole populism thing. I mean, somebody might say Donald Trump talks in short sentences.
Yes, he does. Yes. Oh. Yep. And that, which also makes him dangerous. But to me, the difference is that Donald Trump is basically inspiring people's fears, and Paine was inspiring people's hopes. Paine was saying, "We can do it." Especially starting with common sense. I mean, there were other things, shorter things he'd written beforehand, but, you know, with common sense, he was saying, we should be independent, and we can win. We can do it. The greatest military power on earth, they can't touch us. We'll win. Which is a very different message, I think. He was, in a way, the opposite of Trump in his philosophy, because he, even then, you know, he said, above all things, this is in common sense, that the most important thing of all was freedom of religious choice. That, above all, is that's what he said in common sense. So the idea of suggesting that you would not let Muslims into the country, or that you would persecute them in any way whatsoever, would be absurd to him. And in fact, as a deist, his belief and the belief of deism in general was that everyone had a right to their own religion, including deists. But the two groups, I think, in colonial times in America that particularly would have helped were Catholics and Jews, because they were the two suppressed religions. Even though Paine was completely against the Bible, and all religious books. So, but yes, I think they come from opposite ends, but they appeal to the masses, to the popular people, because they speak in a language that people can understand.
His characterization of government as a necessary evil has been misunderstood.
Yes, I address that in the play, because I read that through the play. I read obviously some of his writings, just bits and pieces from different works. But I read that quote and then I stop and say, now this I need to talk about, because Paine was a propagandist, and that was not a bad thing. That was a good thing then. He wrote to convince people of a position, and he was writing to inspire people to go to war against England. So he also, you know, he wrote that if God, and he used God a lot, although he was not using it because he was a deist in the way that most people were assuming. He wrote, I'm sure, again, you know this, he wrote that if God had meant England, and this is not an exact quote, to rule America, he would have placed the two countries closer together, right? And people would go, yeah, that's right. I mean, they're 3,000 miles away. So he would write things like that. But he did. Now, there's this passage in Common Sense about gathering under the tree, about if people were in a far distant land, that if a few people were marooned, they would have to work together to help each other. Otherwise, individually, they would all die. And then as they grew, they would meet under the tree, the branches of a tree, to basically govern themselves. But then as they grew to be too many to all stand under the branches, they would need to elect people to represent them. And then he has this, you know, this whole thing about the elected must always have the same concerns as the electors. They must always return to the people regularly, and they must also leave office regularly, so they don't become, so that these representatives don't come to have different needs and desires than the general public.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, if you have someone who's been in the Senate here now for 40 years with great health care, he or she may forget what it's like to not have health insurance, kind of thing.
When people on the right today, you know, the sort of Goldwater Reagan limited government people, extol limited government, it's usually, I mean, it's usually because it infringes on private property and private profiteering. But
yes.
Payne had a very different idea.
Absolutely. I mean, to him, the ideal was that you would not need government. That would be the pure utopian idea, because we would all, we all the people, would all look after each other. Now, and obviously that's a, it, when you get to a country of 300 million people, that's kind of a hard concept. But that was his core idea, that, that the only reason you need government is because of our vices, because we don't care enough about each other, because we're lazy, because we get self-centered. So yes, he would love to have a government, a society where the society ran everything, not the government. But he said, until we get to that point, we have to have government.
And government has to then sort of be a neutral referee in a way. And I've always suspected that the on the right, there's a certain cynicism about human nature that neutrality is impossible. And I often think that's what fuels this limited government thing, that, you know, they figure, well, since everyone's out for itself, we might as well just have a, you know, a game and everybody go for it, and the social
right.
Darwinism and all that. And
right.
and they suspect any time, you know, somebody on the left articulates ideals, they think it's, you know, hogwash and doublespeak.
Well, yes, and also there's a quote, the greatest defense of all to the great father is when we torment and render each other miserable.
Yeah.
Now that's a profound statement, that our job, our purpose, our what we need to be doing on earth is to make other people happy.
Right.
Not to say to hell with you.
Yeah.
Not to say if you're poor, that's because you're either stupid or lazy. But if you're poor, let me help you.
Look at the way Payne, you know, the incredible sale of common sense, and he donated all the money away. And I venture that probably Glenn Beck has not done the same with the profits from his books.
I mean, Payne did that all his life, and then he was always complaining that he had no money.
Yes.
And he many times petitioned Congress to be paid, to be given money for all he'd done towards the war.
Right.
But it was. I can see why people sometimes said he's a real pain, you know, because
yeah.
he would give the money away and then he wouldn't have any money.
Yeah.
But it's true. I mean, he could have been an extremely rich man through his life.
Tell me about Bob Basso and these little short films on YouTube and how he came under your crosshairs.
Well, the truth is, I think I can say this publicly, that there's the Thomas Paine Society in Pasadena, who have been an incredible partner with me, have supported me from the very, very beginning, have given some money towards my work, I've done performances there where they have their offices. They actually introduced Bob Basso to Thomas Paine.
Oh.
Bob Basso was he had been a sports commentator in Hawaii, and I don't know whether he's ever really been an actor. He's been a motivational speaker. He still is. But I think they take the blame But what happened was that he took this idea of pain and basically turned it upside down.
Mm.
You know, he helped to invent the Tea Party.
Mm.
I think he was the first, in his first big video, it's where he holds up a tea bag and says, send these to your representatives.
Oh.
And that was at least, I don't know whether he first thought of that or whether he was the first big promoter of the tea bag idea. And he basically, I mean, if you've seen him on my site, those are just clips, he shouts all the time.
Yeah, he's very strident, yeah.
He sort of says the opposite of what Payne would say. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, just, in fact, I would not be surprised if Donald Trump hasn't studied those Bob Basso's tapes. And the thing is, the first one on went up on YouTube had 11 million views.
Oh.
So it is much, I mean, he talks about invasions from south of the border, and I just felt I had to respond to them.
Yeah.
And it was not easy, because what on my site, yes, I've got like a little bit of him, and then I've got me kind of responding on the play. But some of the things he said were so out there that it was really hard to find a way to respond to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were so far beyond anything that Payne would ever have said.
Or also the way he says it.
Well, yes, and he just shouts, and he's. I mean, I think he does a terrible job of when he sort of calls on God and things like that. It's really rather embarrassing.
Yeah.
And he looks ridiculous, and he doesn't sound anything like Payne. It's like me dressing up as Gandhi and doing videos about invading Iran. To me, that would be the equivalent, you know. It's that far out. So, in a way, I mean, I thank him now, because it was a kind of inspiration. If you know, if ever there was a proof of a person being misunderstood and misused, then there's that and Glenn Beck's book Common Sense. Yeah, that was another one.
Going back a moment to Payne, just a tangent. You mentioned about his being an inventor and the bridge. He had been in England a corset maker by trade, and that sort of surprised me.
Well, that was because that's what his father did.
Oh.
And in fact, they lived in Thetford, which is not, I mean, it's 30 miles from the coast of Norfolk. I think his father was also a sailmaker in reality, but he did also make corsets for women. And because corsets, any woman who could afford a corset would have one, because that's how you were supposed to look.
Mm-hmm.
So Payne was sort of apprenticed by his father. It was not like a profession of choice.
Right.
And when he was 16, I think, the 7 Years' War started, which was really the First World War, in a sense. And he went to London, and when he was 17, he signed on a ship as a privateer, which is like a legal pirate, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And he never went back to making corsets. I mean, it was not something he wanted to do. It was it's because that's what his father did.
Mm-hmm. But it does show skills, craft skills.
Oh, well, yes. I guess, yeah, work with his hands.
Right. And fabric and all that. But what kind of formal education, if any, did he have?
He was at school till he was about 13.
Okay.
Now, the English school system at that time, relative to the level of knowledge in the world, was a very, very good system.
Mm.
You got a good education. However, his father, who was Quaker,
mm-hmm.
did not want him learning Latin or Greek, which is interesting, because that's perhaps one of the reasons that he wrote in such straightforward, simple language. He'd never learned or read the classics, or he would only have read any classics in a probably not very well translated.
So was the Quaker view on the Renaissance very?
I think it was. I mean, now I don't really know a lot, but
yeah.
I think the view was that Quakers, you know, all that sort of beautiful form and style and painting and carving and sculpture, and they didn't really like all that.
All the Baroque stuff, right.
Yeah, they like things to be very simple.
Right.
And so I think the complex philosophies of the Greeks particularly didn't really interest them. They had a philosophy to do with God and how you live your life on earth and how you dress and eat, and that was about it.
Right.
You know, simple.
Simplicity and discipline and thrift and all that. Yeah.
Which had a big impact on Paine all his life, without any question.
But he had large parts of the Bible memorized, because when he was in prison in France, isn't that where he was working on the Age of Reason?
Yes. That, Age of Reason 1, he finished the night he was arrested, but even then, and you're certainly right about Age of Reason 2, he was working on in prison. But even with 1, he didn't have a Bible in the house.
Yeah.
But he was he had one of those memories where he could, he knew most of the Bible, like word for word, which is pretty extraordinary. So he could quote from it just from memory.
But when he returned to America, he had a lot of Americans who disliked him for various reasons. He had published a letter to Washington that where he was criticizing Washington. It seems he had his mixing personal antagonism in there, perhaps. The Age of Reason, really, religious America was not ready for that. His support of the French Revolution had the Federalists after him.
Yep.
And apparently only 6 people attended his funeral in 1809?
Yes, and 3 were freed slaves. And a fourth was Madame de Bonneville, who was the wife of his French publisher, who he had lived with them for 5 years, when he was frightened to come back because the British Navy was still trying to find him and hang him.
Wow.
For sedition. So he nearly got guillotined. He nearly was hung. When he arrived in New York, I think, because he was still very famous, the first 3 taverns he went to refused to serve him a drink.
Wow.
Now, he still had friends and admirers here, but not that many. Because I think by then, in fact, Age of Reason Part 2nd in particular had helped to spur... I think it was one of the great awakenings.
Yeah.
It certainly.
Oh, it played a role. It played a role in that. That was a reaction.
Yes, it helped to bring together the Federalists, the politicians, and the Calvinist clergy. And I say in the play so that politicians, rather than rising in the morning to seek the truth, go to bed at night with the great American moral order. And this idea was the beginning of this idea that you were either Christian or infidel. And I say in the play, one can but throw one's ideas to the wind. Where they are blown is beyond any man's power.
Do you think Thomas Paine will always be only for the few? Is it possible that there could be a larger rediscovery of him and a real understanding?
I'm hoping so.
You're listening to Direct Talk Radio, conversations with writers, directors, and artists. This is Joseph Miller, and my guest this week is English-American actor and writer Ian Ruskin, who brings his one-man play, To Begin the World Over Again, The Life of Thomas Paine, to the Faulkner Gallery on Saturday, February 13th at 3 p.m. The free performance is sponsored by the Institute of World Culture.
Can I talk for a minute about
absolutely
an idea that, well, it's going to happen. In fact, we're launching our new website tomorrow. And to coincide with, the thing is, the film will be offered to PBS stations across America through the organization that does that. Right? But every station decides for themselves what they want their lineup to be. So we have no idea how many stations will air it. Now, with The Bridges, which was a much more difficult film to sell, in that it was a 90-minute film, and also Bridges was not nearly as well known as Paine. And we got the film in front of half of America. Whether they watched it, I don't know.
Mm.
But they had it on their, you know, in on their televisions. And I think Payne can do much better. But one of the things we're going to do, and really starting tomorrow, is we have this really detailed plan for people to have sneak preview screening parties. And this could be in your home. It could be at your club or church or school. It could be at your company, in your company. And we charge a little bit, but not very much.
I mean, that's fantastic.
For a home screening, $10. For a nonprofit screening, $50 or $100. And then $500 or $1,000 for a corporation.
Mm.
But the idea is, and there's a whole screening kit. You get things,
and so
talking
there,
points, you get colonial recipes, you get an action plan, which is basically to encourage all your friends to register people to vote. And there are three organizations that we list. And this is, they're all nonpartisan. But Payne would want everyone to vote,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure.
And is there social media follow through so people can communicate about the...
Oh, yes, absolutely. And we encourage, we have flyers and posters and banners for Facebook and Twitter, and asking people to put stuff up, to send us information, and we'll put it up. We're also going to we're going to have a debate page where we say, as long as it's not obscene or violent or advertising something, we will put up whatever you send us.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you watch the film and you hate it, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
We'll put that up as
mm-hmm.
long as you know, are polite. But you can say, I think this is a terrible story. I think this man is evil. You can say that. That's fine. Because we're hoping to get we want the Tea Party organizations to watch the film as well.
Of course.
We want everyone to watch it. But anyway, so we also have the American Library Association, who we are hoping to have, well, let's hundreds of screenings in libraries across America. And the libraries, as the kit, they also get either two or four DVDs to then put on their shelves, because we're not actually selling the DVDs yet, not until July.
Mm-hmm.
But so the idea with these screening parties, and if any you know, one is listening and wants to do one, they just go to the lifeofthomaspayne.org.
Okay, stop for a moment. So lifeofthomaspayne.org.
The Life of Thomas Paine.
The Life of Thomas Paine. .org. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as it's starting tomorrow, well, it'll be up by the time this is out. We would like to have thousands of screening parties. I mean, literally, that's our aim. There are so many organizations that the NAACP, Payne's fierce fight against slavery, the ACLU. I did a performance that was mainly for members of the Los Angeles chapter of the ACLU. They loved it because there are so many parallels about freedom of information. Payne was the first real whistleblower in American history. So there are so many groups, and they don't just have to be of the left.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say I would love all kinds of groups. Churches. Now, I've done the play for Unitarians, that they're a kind of obvious group to do the play for. But I would love all kinds of churches
mm-hmm.
to watch this, and then let people can then talk. Because in the play and in the film, I only read short passages, but in one paragraph, I take the Bible to pieces, and this is all his words.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good thing for people to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I talk about men in brightly colored robes in buildings full of brightly colored glass, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't watch the film in one of those buildings and talk about it. You know, because there are so many, I think there are so many issues, and especially, you know, the film was going to be distributed last year, and we said no, we wanted to be in the presidential election year. It might create some discussion.
So these possibilities for home and community screening will be going from February 2nd until all the way through to November? In possibilities?
Well, at the moment, we're saying from April 1st, till July 4th.
Okay.
And the reason we've picked those dates is that one possible time for us to aim for the airings is the July 4th weekend.
I see.
This is one idea. But so we've got the April, May, those 3 months. That's the idea. It can always be extended. So for home screenings, it's one screening, and you get this whole kit, and it's $10, and you get a DVD. obviously, to screen it. We also are going to have a downloadable version.
Okay.
Then if it's an organization, in those 3 months, you can screen it up to 5 times.
Ah.
And literally, if it's what I call a nonprofit or community, if in the however many screenings you have, up to five, if you have a total of up to 99 people, it's $50. And you get 2 DVDs.
Okay.
If you have over 99 people, it's $100, and you get 4 DVDs and 2 CDs. So it's really not a lot of money.
No.
You know?
Well, congratulations to you and whoever has been supporting you. I think that's really fantastic. That's a really good sign that there's this kind of follow through.
Yes, yes. And the money will go to we have the distribution in America, but we want to have foreign distribution. We want to make there's a program called The Brain, which is a way of doing of researching on a website. It's an incredible program. Once we make it, say you start with Thomas Paine, you could go to Benjamin Franklin. And then from Benjamin Franklin, you could go to his lightning rod. Or from Paine, you could go to the English monarch. And from there, you could go to the English slave trade. And from there, you could go to Jefferson's slaves. And then to Jefferson, back to Thomas Paine.
Uh-huh.
Endless combinations. Uh-huh. And at each stop, we'll have clips from the film. We also have the audio version. We have music. We have scholars who will write pieces. So it's going to be, but it's a huge project. So that's also where money will go to. We also want to bring out, well, at least initially, a Spanish subtitle version of the film, and then hopefully other languages as well. Paine was a citizen of the world, so
yes,
we shouldn't be restricted to the English language.
Right.
So we have lots of ideas of making this bigger and bigger.
That's fantastic. So thank you very much, Ian Ruskin, for talking with us today on Direct Talk. This has been fascinating, and we really look forward to your appearance at the Santa Barbara Public Library, the Faulkner Gallery. That'll be February 13th at 3 in the afternoon. It is a free public event that would please Thomas Paine, democratically available to all.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk about Paine, and I really I appreciate the fact that you know quite a lot about him. That just makes the conversation a lot more fun.
You've been listening to Direct Talk Radio, conversations with writers, directors, and artists. For more information about this program, to listen to archives, or to communicate with me, Joseph Miller, visit www.thewritejoe.com. That is thewritejoe.com. You can also post comments on Facebook. Go to the Classical Now's Facebook page. That's The Classical Now. For information on the Santa Barbara performance of To Begin the World Over Again, The Life of Thomas Paine, visit the Institute of World Culture's website. That is worldculture.org. For information about the work of Ian Ruskin and registration for home or group preview screening parties of his PBS special, look him up on the web. That is Ian Ruskin, IanRuskin.